This is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the Ladies' Home Journal, February 2011 edition. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is The Best Way to Feed Your Dog. It's a question and answer section that they have rounded up some veterinary experts. First question, I thought that feeding my dog was just a question of throwing down a bowl of kibbles once a day. Is this something I really need to think about? Answer, small things can actually make a big difference. For example, eating only once a day can cause excess stomach acid and vomiting in some dogs. Eating twice a day, morning and early evening, is best for medium and large dogs like beagles, and Labrador retrievers. If you feed them more often, they may develop a weight problem. Smaller dogs like poodles and Yorkies tend to metabolize food faster, so you may need to give them 3 meals a day. Put out a bowl of water with each meal as well and keep it filled so he stays hydrated. Filter water is great, but tap is fine. Next question, does it matter whether I feed my dog wet or dry food? No. Both provide the right nutrients, so you can base your decision on what your dog likes best and on what's convenient. The vast majority of pet owners prefer dry food. It's easy to store and serve, and it's cheaper, too. Dr. Hosenhaus, a senior medical advisor at the Animal Medical Center in New York City, says sometimes he recommends switching a sick dog to wet food if he has a sore mouth or needs extra hydration, or if the wet food encourages him to eat more. Next question. My dog has bad breath. Does that mean I'm feeding her the wrong diet? Answer, probably not, but it does mean that you need to brush her teeth, says Rebecca Rumyard, vet. Use a toothbrush and toothpaste designed specifically for dogs, and aim to brush every day. Your dog's breath is never going to smell minty fresh, but if the odor suddenly gets very bad, it may be a red flag that she's sick and needs to see the vet. Next question. I'd like to make my dog's food myself. Is that okay? Answer, yes, but it's hard to ensure that homemade food contains all the right nutrients. Dogs need a healthy balance of protein, carbohydrates, and fat, as well as a variety of vitamins and minerals. So it's smart to talk to your vet first. And don't give your dog raw meat, one of the many recent doggy diet trends. While some pet owners like the idea of feeding their dogs this kind of diet they would have eaten in the wild, the digestive systems of most domesticated dogs are not equipped to handle raw meat. They can become sick from salmonella or parasites, the two biggest threats, and even E. coli. Next question. My kids sneak bits of food to our dog at the table. Is that bad? Answer, you definitely shouldn't get in the habit of feeding your dog table scraps. Not only will it throw off the nutritional balance of his diet, but there are many seemingly innocuous people foods that are dangerous for dogs. For example, grapes and raisins can lead to kidney failure. Chocolate may cause seizures. Avocados can cause vomiting and diarrhea. And the sweetener xylitol may harm your dog's liver. Last question, how can I tell if my dog has a food allergy? Answer, dogs can develop allergies to ingredients like beef, chicken, wheat, and soy. The most common sign is itching. Your dog will compulsively lick or scratch her front feet, groin, or ears, and the skin will be red and irritated. She may also vomit or have diarrhea. If she regularly has some or all of these symptoms, call the vet who can help you figure out whether an allergy is to blame. Dress codes. We've talked to 5 women who dress according to their faith, not mainstream fashion. What does it mean? How do you ride a bike with that on? Isn't it hot? Yep, we went there. We asked them everything. This article is by Lorraine Alley. The first one is about Sister Ray Roy, a Catholic nun. It makes people think about God. Although Sarah Ray was raised Catholic, she never planned to become a nun. In fact, as a little girl growing up in Illinois, she dreamed of the day she would become a veterinarian. That idea ended in college, once I realized I couldn't do chemistry or physics, Sister Sarah, 33, says with a laugh. She soon changed her major to human development, then went for a master's in social work. While she was in grad school, some nuns gave a talk at the Union Center, urging students to think about their vocation. That renaissanced with Ray, and soon after she graduated, at age 24, she joined the Order of St. Francis of the Immaculate Conception and began her confirmation as a Catholic sister. Today, she's the only nun under age 65 in her Priory Order who actually looks the part. Most nuns stopped wearing the veil in the late 1960s after the Vatican ruled that nuns should simplify and modify their habits, and most don't wear the habit. That a habit is a black frock over a white blouse. Sister Sarah wears both. It wasn't easy to adopt a garment that was practically extinct among her fellow nuns. Sister Sarah says, I was living as a sister for 3 years before I chose to wear it, but I felt there was something missing. She didn't want to make a choice that would separate her from the rest of the order, but for her, the tradition felt right. I think when I wear the veil and habit, it makes people think about God. If just for a second, she says. It also gives me a sense of identity. This is who I am. Actually, finding a veil wasn't too easy either. At first, Sister Sarah borrowed one from an older nun and had it tailored to fit her. After searching online, she finally located a store that still sold them and mail ordered a couple. But that store went out of business, so Sister Sarah now has them tailor-made. Her parents supported her decision to wear the habit, she says, though her mother would still prefer that she's wearing something more fashionable and less nunnish. Sister Sarah's old school ways are actually a hit with the students at the University of Illinois' Urbana-Champaign campus, where she works as a religious counselor. They love the fact that someone close to their age is wearing a garment they've seen only in history books and the movies. They like the idea that I'm proclaiming my faith so publicly, says Sister Sarah. A lot of them are looking for structure and solid truth, and even if this isn't the path they take, I think they admire someone who has. The next article is called, It Shows Pride, Plus It's Incredibly Comfortable. This article is about Anita Patel, a Hindu. She has never lived in India, but Anita Patel dresses as if she's traversing the streets of Mumbai. On any given day, the 47-year-old Dallas grade school teacher can be found in a traditional pantsuit called a shalwar kameez, a long tunic matching pants and shoulder scarf, or a long kurta blouse over slacks. For special occasions, she dons a colorful sari and a red bindi, a decorative spot of color in the middle of her forehead, just above her eyebrows. Patel was born in England to Hindu parents, and the family moved to the United States when she started high school. Her parents always urged her to dress more traditionally, which of course made her gravitate towards jeans and t-shirts. But since marrying an Indian man and having two children, both who are now grown, Patel found herself moving back toward the traditional dress associated with Hinduism. Patel now attends temple in her Dallas suburb, as well as going to weekly Hindu study groups to get to the roots of her belief. I'm learning more and more about the real meaning behind the rituals I perform and the meaning behind what I wear, rather than just wearing it. It turns out there are no overarching Hindu dictates on what should or shouldn't be worn, with the significance depends on your point of view. For example, the shape and color of the bindi can connotate a woman's theological outlook or simply signify that she is married. For Patel, it's the latter. Her reasons for dressing traditionally are pretty uncomplicated. I feel like the native dress from India, where Hinduism was born, shows pride in my motherland, ancestors, and faith. Plus, she says, it's incredibly comfortable. As for blending into the community around her, Patel really doesn't feel the need to. Her life isn't that different from that of her colleagues. She grabs a vegetarian lunch, most Hindus don't eat meat, at a sandwich shop near her school and works out in t-shirts and track pants at her local gym. True, she stands out, but if her appearance does elicit a reaction, it's almost always a friendly one. I've never felt people were looking at me negatively because I dress oddly, she says. I go to the grocery store and get compliments. They ask a lot of questions, especially when I wear a sari. What kind of material is it? How do you put it on? They also ask if there's a place where they can buy one. I joke and say, yes, there's a giant mecca for saris. It's called India. The next article is called The Bible Says to Dress Modestly. This article is about Sarah Schultz, a conservative Christian, and the way she dresses. At St. Joseph's Hospital in Cremona, Indiana, Sarah Schultz is the only ICU nurse whose scrubs are, in fact, a skirt. That's because Schultz is a conservative Christian who refers to the Bible when deciding what to wear. That goes for her hairstyle, too. In Corinthians it says, "But if a woman hath long hair, it is to glorify to her, for her hair is given for covering." Says Schultz, who has never cut her hair, "I believe abiding by those words makes me a good Christian." Schultz attends the same conservative church she and her husband were raised in since childhood. "I grew up dressing modestly," says Schultz, who wears no makeup. "I rode bikes, roller skated, and skied in skirts. My parents thought it was the right thing to do, and it didn't stop me from being active. In junior high, I was the only one in gym class who wore a jean skirt instead of shorts, but I made it work." There are no clear-cut guidelines for conservative Christians the way they are for, say, Orthodox Jews, but Schultz and other women from her non-denominational church know to wear their hemlines below the knee and their necklines well above the breastbone. They set their standards according to the Bible passage that says a woman should dress modestly, avoiding elaborate outfits or fancy hairstyles. We live by that, and it forms how we appear in public. Schultz buys all her clothes from mainstream department stores, but it's not always easy to find the right thing, she says, especially when it comes to work attire. For instance, her scrub skirts aren't sold anywhere. The only scrub dresses I've seen for sale are borderline way too short, so I started buying material and making them myself. Ironically, when Schultz and her friends from church go to stores and restaurants, they almost always turn heads, since their humble and unassuming appearance makes them stand out. People sometimes approach us and ask what church we belong to. I think that's their polite way of checking whether or not we're part of some cult, she says. Wearing her faith on her sleeve is important to her. It's a way to celebrate her relationship with God. But she knows the choice can sometimes make other people uncomfortable. People think I might judge or condemn them for not being pious enough. But really, I don't think what I believe is the only answer. It's just right for me. The next article is about Sarah Elizabeth Segal, an Orthodox Jew. There's no need to show off my body. From her stockings in midsummer to her close-toe shoes and long-sleeved shirts, Sarah Elizabeth Segal is not your average Los Angeles girl. That's because 27-year-old librarian is also an Orthodox Jew who adheres to a strict interpretation of the religious laws found in the Jewish holy book, the Torah. The point is to be attractive, but not attracting, says Segal, who is married and has a toddler son. God gave us these precious souls, and I really want to shine through. There's no need to show off my body when I rather have people know my inner essence. What sets Orthodox Jews like Segal apart in their strict adherence to their faith and to rituals that affect everything from diet to their dress, the dress code emphasized modesty. My skirts must cover my knees, whether I'm standing or sitting, and my shirts must rise above my collarbone and cover my elbows. I cover my hair, too. I could wear a scarf or a hat, but I wear wigs because they're less conspicuous. Orthodox Jews believe a woman's hair should be seen only by her husband. Getting an inconspicuous wig can be an expensive proposition. Segal's range anywhere from $400 to $2,500 and are made from human hair. People often ask me, why cover up your own hair with someone else's? Isn't that cheating? I grappled with that question and wore headscarves at first, but really, they're hard to match with other clothing, and they make me stand out. The whole point is not to be conspicuous, and that's what a wig achieves. Also, it's not like I'm wearing some long, blonde-eyed, catchy thing. It looks nice, not sexy. When Seagal hangs out with non-observant friends, her orthodox lifestyle really doesn't get in the way. Thankfully, there are tons of kosher restaurants in L.A., she says. That makes it easy for me to be proactive and say, ooh, let's eat here. But she does have to make obvious concessions to her faith when engaging in activities like swimming or working out in a gym. She swims in women-only pools and wears a high neck top and knee-length skirt with leggings underneath, all made from swimwear material. And to work out, Seagal wears a knee-length skirt and leggings, and she doesn't work out in front of men. I can do most everything, but people do stare, she says. It's L.A., and they're wondering, why doesn't she just wear shorts like everyone else? The next one is about, it reminds me of my commitment to God. It is Seba Sida, a conservative Muslim. Over her typical American clothing, Saba wears a face veil, a long headscarf, and a roomy outer garment, even while riding a jet ski. I put a life jacket over my abaya, the outer garment, she explains, and that keeps it from flapping around. Believe it or not, my niqab, the face veil, stays in place most of the time. Of course, all those clothes can be burdensome and uncomfortable, but they remind me of my commitment to God, so I'm willing to make some sacrifice. Overall, covering makes me feel like a better Muslim and a stronger woman. Sida, 33, who lives in Newark, Delaware, with her husband and three kids, represents a small minority of Muslim Americans who cover from head to toe in the name of Islam. Wearing a face veil is not a requirement, but it is a religious choice. She says it helps her remain modest and humble and ensures she maintains platonic relationship with men other than her husband. But her clothing isn't stocked at the local mall. She orders her garments online from Egypt and Lebanon and Jordan. She started covering her face with a veil as a sophomore at the University of Houston, where she was a biology major. Her parents were Pakistani immigrants and were not thrilled. Her mother wore a headscarf but feared that Saba's veil was going too far. They were afraid that the niqab would make me stand out too much, she said, but they eventually accepted it when they realized it was more than a passing phase. Today, she is well known in the Islamic community as the founder of a Muslim women's magazine called Daughters of Adam, and as a featured blogger on the website MuslimMatters.org. She says covering doesn't stop her from doing normal things like shopping for kids' clothes, lunching with friends who don't cover, she said. She did have to learn to eat with the veil on, and she had to learn to stop laughing, and her kids had to learn to stop laughing when she did, or play in the park with her kids. The other children always are curious about me. They say, look, Mommy, it's a ghost or an angel. It's the parents who look uncomfortable. Dressing in an outfit more synonymous with Saudi Arabia than the Eastern Seaboard does raise eyebrows, but it doesn't bother Saba. From the outside, they may think, whoa, she's so oppressed, but to me, it's the opposite. The loose clothing and face covering mean I no longer feel objectified by men. It makes me feel confident and liberated. Your money, your health. Are you overwhelmed by high copays, deductibles, and other health care costs? Most of us have seen the amount we pay for medical care go up. But the news isn't all bad. There are a lot of concrete ways to stretch your medical dollars and still get quality care. Check out these strategies that can help you save money. First strategy, you need a pricey drug your prescription doesn't cover. So what should you do? You shop around. First, ask your doctor if a generic version is available. Generics can cost far less than brand name drugs and often are covered by your insurance. If a generic doesn't exist or if your doctor has a medical reason for prescribing the brand name drug, you've got to go shopping. Prices for drugs can vary by as much as 400% depending on the pharmacy. Often, online retailers like drugstore.com offer the lowest price. In addition, look into mail order prescriptions like Medco or Express Scripts, which allow you to buy in bulk for up to 60% off the pharmacy prices. This option works best if you're purchasing medicine you regularly take for a chronic condition, such as asthma. Lipitor, a commonly prescribed cholesterol-lowering drug, for instance, can set you back as much as $140 for a 30-day supply. But by 3 months by mail, and those pills could cost you just $16.50. Another trick? Split your pills. There's no law against it. Just ask your doctor to prescribe the double-strength tablets instead of the prescribed 100 milligrams, for instance. The cost of the prescription is the same, but the 200 milligram pills will last twice as long when cut in half. Just pick up an expensive pill splitting device at the drugstore. Be aware that pill splitting doesn't work with all medications. You cannot use them on gel caps or time release drugs. Your next problem? You need to see a doctor out of network. So what should your strategy be? Be prepared to negotiate. Many insurance companies will pay 70% to 80% of reasonable and customary charges when you see a health care provider outside your network. But reasonable and customary is the tricky part, says Tom, a senior executive with the benefits consulting firm Towers Watson. Say your bill is $100. If your insurer pays 80% of out-of-network charges, you may be expecting a check for $80. But your insurer might determine that reasonable and customary charges for that type of doctor should be $80, not $100. In that case, you would only be reimbursed $64. Thanks to legal action by the New York State Attorney General's Office, the prices that insurers use to calculate reasonable and customary charges have become more realistic. Nonetheless, to protect yourself when you know you're going out of network, always ask your insurer what is reasonable and customary fees for that specific treatment. Then go back to your doctor and ask if she'll accept that amount your insurance company is willing to pay. Next problem. You need a root canal and a crown, but your dental insurance maxes out at $1,000. What's your strategy? Good dentists know what kind of work can be extended over several months. If you stagger the procedures over separate calendar years, you can get more of the cost reimbursed than if you had them all in 1 year. A temporary crown, for instance, will often last for 12 months. So if you have a root canal and get the temporary crown this year, you'll likely hit your maximum. But wait until next year to get the permanent crown, and you'll be reimbursed again. Another cost saver? Try a local dental school. The dental students are supervised by qualified teachers and often offer excellent care for a third of the price. Next problem? You need to schedule a surgery or visit the hospital. Here's your strategy. Watch out for unexpected out-of-network charges. You may assume that since your surgery or primary care physician at a particular hospital is in your network, the other health care providers you see at the hospital are too. But that isn't always so. And they could bill you for their full fee. Or the lab work you have done at the hospital may not be covered because the hospital's lab isn't in network. Be sure to ask the admissions staff what doctors you'll be seeing, what x-rays and labs work you'll need, and whether those services will be paid for by your insurance at in-network rates. If some providers are out of network, ask if there's in-network alternatives, or more likely, if the out-of-work doctors will accept your insurance fee. In many cases, they will, and they will even handle the negotiations with your insurance company directly. Next question. You think you may need to go to the ER. Your strategy? Think twice. Emergency room bills can be sky high, especially in a hospital that's not part of your insurance company's network. It makes sense to avoid the ER unless you are truly facing an emergency. The top three reasons for ER visits in 2007 were sprains and strains, superficial injuries like bruises and cuts, and upper respiratory infections. These are all things that certainly need attention, but not necessarily in an ER. If you're contemplating whether to go to an ER, if you have a swollen wrist that may be broken, for instance, call your doctor's office first or head to an urgent care center. These facilities specialize in treating mild injuries, and insurers recommend them because they're cheaper than ERs. You'll like the fact that you probably won't wait as long either. Call your insurance company to find one near you and confirm that it will cover the visit. Next problem, you need to fight a denial from your insurance company. Here's your strategy. File an appeal. If your insurer won't pay for a claim and you think it should, you have the right to appeal the decision. But you must be sure to meet all deadlines, file all forms, and otherwise follow your insurance company's rules and procedures carefully, or your appeal may be invalid. When drafting your appeal, enlist your doctor or billing expert's help. Say you needed a follow-up ultrasound for an ovarian cyst. Your OBGYN can help you formulate an argument and provide any medical records and other backup you'll need to make your case. About 53% of appeals succeed in our state, says Kansas Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager. And according to advocacy groups, the success is similar nationwide. So appeal that decision if you need to. The new rules for flexible spending. One of the best ways to save money on health care is to take advantage of flexible spending accounts, which let you set aside a certain amount of money before taxes each year, usually through paycheck deductions, to pay for out-of-pocket health care costs. Many health expenses are eligible, including deductibles, copays, eyeglasses, dental work, mental health counseling, and more. Because you use pre-tax dollars, you can save about 20%. But there is a catch. If you don't spend all that you put away each year, you may have to forfeit it. What's more, the new health reform law makes some major changes to flex spending accounts. Starting January 1, 2011, over-the-counter drugs will no longer be eligible expenses unless you have been specifically directed to use them by your doctor. Previously, you could get reimbursed for any over-the-counter medications, and starting in 2013, the annual maximum you can contribute to your flex spending account will be $2,500. Currently, companies set the annual maximums, and many allow higher. Neither of these changes should deter you from setting up an account, though. If a big elective medical or dental procedure is in the offing, like LASIK surgery or tooth implants, you may want to schedule these treatments while you can still pay with pre-tax dollars. Here's some quick health tips. To prevent cold sores, when your lips are dry and cracked, it's easier for the virus that causes those ugly fluid-filled blisters to invade. Use plenty of moisturizing lip balm and make sure it has an SPF of at least 15, as sun exposure during the winter can also trigger cold sores. Stop sinusitis. Dry, heated indoor air can trigger chronic stuffiness and sinus inflammation. Keep nasal mucus thin and free-flowing by staying well hydrated. Use a saltwater nasal spray or rinse at the first sign of a stuffy nose. Running a humidifier can help too, but make sure you clean it regularly to avoid the growth of mold. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long. Until next time.